Welcome on to a Monday night edition of the Dunked On Basketball Podcast. We had Mike Schmitz on last week to get the scouting perspective on the draft. Today we are going to have ESPN numbers guru, some of the best draft translations in the business, Kevin Pelton. And the good news, Kevin, is there aren't any University of Washington players in the draft this year, so we can actually rely on your analysis to be objective.
Well, there's Robert Upshaw. There's mixed emotions there, certainly.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, I guess he didn't finish the season, so they were actually like going to be okay. I don't follow college basketball. They're actually going to be okay with him until he left, right? Was that kind of coincide with a downswing for the team?
Yeah, that would be fair to say. They were already slumping a little bit once they got into conference play. They were, I think, a little 500 in conference play with him. But then after he got dismissed from the team, they lost something like 8 of the next 9 games. So, yeah, that would be fair to call that a downturn. We have the best defense in the Pac-12 to near the bottom of the league.
So we discussed your methods a little bit on the previous show that we had. You know, you've consulted for the Pacers before. You know, you've been doing this draft translation stuff now for a long time. But let's say I am one of the basketball PhD type GMs out there who doesn't necessarily believe in numbers, or maybe not believe in it, but, you know, don't really understand why your stuff works. So explain to me why I should use your numbers when, you know, I've been watching basketball for 30 years and I know what a good player is just by seeing him.
Well, I think the best answer to that is not that the stats do a better job than scouts at identifying talent, but one of the pieces I wrote with Chad Ford earlier this year in our back and forth that we do that I thought was one of the most important things we did was looking at, hey, what happens when both the stats and the scouts match up as opposed to when they say different things? And it turns out that when somebody was a top 10 pick overall and also in the top 10 of my projections, they were generally very good players. And Michael Beasley every now and again, a Tyrus Thomas, a guy like that who either doesn't live up to expectations or is an outright bust. But those are incredibly rare. Then when you look at the group of guys that were top 10 in the draft but outside my top 10, yeah, pretty good, but not nearly as good. And then the top 10 in my projections but outside the top 10 of the draft, same thing where they actually played a lot less minutes, although there were some really solid players in that group. So either of them on their own, to me, is not as powerful as the combination of both of them.
Yeah, that's how it should be taken, as another tool in the toolbox, you know, just as much as watching a guy, just as much as background. It's just more information. It doesn't settle the score. I mean, and there are plenty of reasons why, you know, not only why the stats don't mean everything, but also there's a ton of contacts that could influence the stats. You know, one guy might be Trey Lyles, for example. You know, he's really low in your projections, but he's also someone who played the three totally out of position at Kentucky just because they needed to get him on the floor. So, you know, maybe if he had played the four, he might have been better. Maybe he wouldn't have been, but you always have to consider the context both in your statistical analysis versus, you know, someone like Cameron Payne. Yeah, he looks awesome on film, but then you have to remember the context that he's going against Ohio Valley Conference guys. So it's all, everything, you know, is a kind of a sliding scale of things to measure and keep in context, but it's also obviously a very valuable tool.
Well, one of my favorite quotes is from my former who said that the stats can't see a game as well as a scout can see a game, but the stats can see all the games, and no scout can possibly see all the games. And I think that measure sums up a lot of the, you know, complementary value to these. You get more of the interpersonal interactions and, like you said, the context of how these stats are compiled by watching a player play in person. But if you see a guy three times and they happen to be his three worst games of the year, it's going to be tough. Even if you know that those are the three worst games of the year, it's really tough for people to correct for that bias mentally.
So your system then creates basically a projection of your warp rankings. Is that how it works?
Yeah. So the way it works, I don't remember how much we went into this last time, but basically it's starts with translating guys' performance in college or internationally to its NBA equivalents, and then put together up to 3 years of that along with a factor regressing to the mean for kind of outlier stats, like somebody who shot, you know, 5 3-pointers and made 2 of them. Probably they're not actually a 40% 3-point shooter. Probably that's just random noise in the data, which it, that will come up again as we go through this, certainly. And then, so all, out of all of that, I have a projection for what their permanent rating, their, you know, PER or statistical plus minus or whatever, their equivalent in my warp system will be as a rookie. And based on that and their age is how I regress that against what they're expected to produce over the next 5 years.
So, all right, why don't we go through your top five here? I'm going off the article that you did about a month and a half ago now with your statistical rankings. For those who have read the article, this is just the pure statistical translation. It's not mixed with sort of where they fall on the big board as well. So you have Russell 1, right? Porzingis at 2,
yep.
Towns 3, Tyus Jones 4, and Kaminsky 5. So already I think people are saying, well, where's Jahlil Okafor? He is number 17 in your rankings. Can you explain to people why that is?
And that's where the regression factor comes in pretty big. So one of the his two-point percentage this season was so far off the charts that this regression factor is pulling it back towards average because of the fact that even though it's a lot more than 5 attempts, it's still not enough attempts that we actually know his true ability just based on his performance at Duke. Now, based on his performance at Duke and watching him play and knowing that he's, you know, been a great post scorer throughout his high school career at every level, then there's probably great confidence subjectively that he actually is going to be this good. And in that case, I can't remember where I said he would have ranked. I think something like 6th.
Yeah. That's assuming that 66% from the field is real, because basically, essentially what you're doing is your system says, nobody actually shoots this well. This can't be real. Is that kind of what it is?
Right. Yeah. And generally, I think that serves it well, but there's an outlier. He's an outlier that kind of is the problem with doing it that way. If he had come back for a second season, then like you'd have enough data that you could pretty confidently talk about his shooting percentage. But the combination of him being so far off the charts and a one-and-done guy makes it hard.
Yeah, and I mean, but to me, it's just from a scouting perspective, it's the same question. You know, I talked about with Mike Schmitz about how he shoots basically 50% on non-dunks and layups, which is a ridiculous amount for a post player, and you know, only 31% of those shots are assisted, so you realize he's posting up on all those shots. And players even in the NBA and college, wherever, you just don't shoot that well from that area. Like, so, you know, one person could say he's going to regress, this isn't real. The other person could say he's a special talent and he's been doing this since high school. He shot 77% from the field in the under-19 World Championships when he was a 17-year-old. You know, you can look at all that and say, well, maybe this is real. So it's really, you know, a perfect example of the context here, but maybe this is some evidence that people need to slow down a little bit on him because it's just not something that anyone does.
I think the one thing it definitely says is in the event he isn't an elite finisher, a really high percentage scorer, then it's going to be hard for him to be quite as good as the best players in this draft.
Yeah, so what is there anything else other than the field goal percentage that the numbers don't particularly like about him?
Well, you know, his defense, predictably. His block percentage is really low for a center. I think there's been, you know, a lot of numbers out there about that, about how rare it is for a player, a center, to have a block rate as low as his and become a really good NBA defender. It's pretty much just Andrew Bogut.
Yeah, wow, it's hard to believe Andrew Bogut had a really low block rate. I mean, and this is, you know, it's so funny too, right? Because anything that you're going to point to almost, and this is the beauty of the draft, or maybe what makes it so miserable, is anything that you're going to point to, there's always an explanation, right? It's a, well, you know what, like, he just wasn't that good of shape, and he was trying to avoid foul trouble. They were relying on him. He didn't have a good backup. He had to play 30 minutes a game. He's the best scoring big in the country. He was told to just stay on the floor and not foul. You know, like, like you, and there's your excuse, right? But I think at least the good thing about the numbers is you're not, they're not as prone to that sort of subjective bias, even if there are reasons to count for them or not count for them. You know, you're not going to just leave things out of that analysis, I guess.
Yeah, Bogut is the counterexample, but if I think back on all the players that I've been told the reason that they didn't do more defensively is because they didn't want to get in foul trouble, the ratio of that actually working out does not seem very good to me.
Yeah, no, and I agree with you. I mean, I do think that that's and having watched a lot of film of Jahlil, I mean, I do think that his physical tools are better than people give him credit for. But, man, I mean, just the effort was not there. And on the defensive glass, too, is another way I would imagine that he is not particularly helped in your numbers.
No, definitely not great there. One of the things that we may talk about later is Kristaps Porzingis. And I did a thing in my piece that's running tomorrow or today, depending when you're listening to this, on Porzingis projecting what he would have played like at Duke. And his rebound rate was almost exactly the same in that role, in that hypothetical.
The same as Okafor's?
Yeah, which obviously gets brought up a lot as a weakness for Porzingis. Okafor's better on the offensive glass, but on defensive glass, virtually the same.
Well, let's talk about Porzingis now. Number two in your rankings, and I imagine that a big part of that is because the ACB league is considered much harder than NCAA.
Absolutely. It's, probably, I haven't looked directly against EuroLeague lately, but I think it might be the best league going at this point. So guys who are playing there get a significant boost because of that.
Well, that's interesting because when you take his numbers, and this might be too arcane for some people, but his numbers were way better in Euro Cup than ACB. So are you doing just ACB or are you doing his Euro Cup and ACB? And for those who don't know, the Euro Cup is basically akin to sort of the one level below Champions League, the name of which escapes me.
Europa
at the
League.
Thank you. Yeah, I knew they changed it. That's why I couldn't remember. So it's basically, it's not teams that sort of aren't at the level of the Euro League, which is the best teams from all the domestic leagues playing against each other. But then it's kind of one level down from there of teams playing against one another. So that's probably not as good a competition as the ACB League overall. Would you say that?
Definitely not. And in term, because of that adjustment, they end up about the same. My translated permanent winning percentage, where 500 is an average player for him, is 461 in the ACB and 473 in Euro Cup.
Gotcha. Okay. Well, that's interesting to know. So now you mentioned he's not that great of a defensive rebounder. What is it that the numbers are so enraptured by him?
I mean, I think one of the big things with him is his steal and block rate. And when you combine that with the context of a guy who is a stretch big offensively, that's a relatively rare combination. So that's a big factor in it. Good usage rate for a guy so young, which I think is, you know, relatively rare for someone playing, again, in a league as competitive as the ACB to be playing a large role offensively. And then a low turnover guy, which somewhat goes hand in hand with, you know, playing as much on the perimeter as he did. But, one of the concerns that Lane Vacherot has brought up in particular is his assist rate. And I think that's offset a little bit by the fact that he's also a low turnover guy.
Yeah, I watched a lot of Porzingis. And I do think that just in watching him move and his athleticism, he has a reputation as an athletic guy. His measurements, Chad Ford just tweeted him out earlier, he's 7'1" and then a 7'6" wingspan. So he is just crazy long. But other than that, I don't think that he is that athletic, and he doesn't really look like that smooth or natural of an athlete other than when he's shooting the ball. That's just my personal opinion. But, you know, you do have to give a lot of credence to the fact that this guy's playing the second best league in the world, and he's has a 25% usage rate. I mean, the guy can get his shot, and, you know, at some point you have to say, all right, maybe he doesn't look like he's that effective, but the numbers say that he was.
I like to think of functional athleticism is different than sort of, you know, the measured athleticism, right? I don't know, the eye test athleticism maybe. So there's guys. Rodney Carney is still the one that comes to mind to me all time. Great dunker, could jump out the gym, could run really well for his size, but he didn't use it whatsoever in games. He never got steals or blocks or rebounds. So to me, what's the point of having that athleticism if you're not actually going to use it?
Yeah, no, you have to actually like decide to jump to do that. So you've got those are your top five. Then you've got R.J. Hunter at 6, Emmanuel Mudiay at 7. Why don't you talk about what you did with him, because he obviously only played a few games in China. I think it was 12. How good do you feel about the projection you did for him, given that the Chinese league is kind of a weird league, and also the fact that there's a relatively small sample there?
Yeah, I would not feel good about it if it said something dramatically different from what scouts were saying, is I guess the position I would take. Now, the one thing is, because of that regression to the mean factor again, I think that, you know, my system is designed to do better with these small samples than, you know, something that didn't take into account any regression factor. And, you know, Lane Vacherot, to bring him up again, because he does wonderful work with projections, has found often that you can pick out promising international prospects from just a handful of games. And I think it's because they're doing things that basically are different from the typical player at that position. And so even if, you know, maybe they don't shoot the ball that well in a small sample or something like that, that kind of gets factored out, and the special talents they have come to the fore. The other place I found that was looking at EuroLeague stats when guys went over there and played just a handful of games before the lockout ended. And, like, they still all came to the top in terms of the translated win percentage because of that factor, even though they've only played two or three games, and who knows how well they did in those couple of games. So it can work. The counter argument is, you know, last year I projected Dante Exum near the top of the draft based on 8 games of the U19 World Championship that he participated on. And certainly that didn't accurately predict how he would play as a rookie. I'm not ready to write him off in any sense just yet, especially because he was so good defensively. But that's kind of the counter argument. So if Mudiay, if it said he was the number one guy, I'm not sure I would read too much to that. If it said he was, you know, a second round pick, I wouldn't read too much into that. But it pretty much ends up right around where the scouts have it.
Yeah, what do the numbers say about what his skills are going to be? One of the things that really jumped out at me, I think he's pretty much above average in nearly every area except for shooting. And I think the fact that he only shot 57% from the line, and then I know this doesn't go into your projections, but, you know, if you go back even just looking at like high school and all-star games like EYBL, he was right around that level as well, 57%. How worrisome is that to him being a shooter versus the fact that he shot 34% from an NBA three-point line in those Chinese leagues games?
Pretty worrisome, because again, that's a really small sample size of three-pointers that he ended up taking. And one of the things I've found, you know, that I've written about at length this year is that free throw percentage actually tends to project your NBA three-point percentage as well as college three-point shooting. Some people have taken on a little bit too far with that to say that it's more important, and that's not really the case, but it is as important. So I think in this case, one of a few where the free throw percentage tells the story much more than the three-point percentage.
Yeah, so I would take it then that you're not projecting him to be a quality shooter at least anytime soon.
No, I don't think so. I think that's unlikely in the league. And the biggest concern I would say I have about that is his free throw attempt rate was a weakness. It's the one statistical weakness where he's in the bottom quarter of players of draft picks at his position. And you worry that there may eventually be a Rondo effect where he shies away from the free throw line because his struggle is there. That's where I think it could really hurt him.
Yeah, watching him on film, I was surprised that he did not get more foul calls, especially because it seemed like, at least in the games that I watched, that the refs are just calling everything in that league. But, you know, I think it didn't appear that he was actually shying away from the free throw line. I think he just, you know, was not getting calls and just doesn't quite have the understanding of how to go into people's bodies yet. But all right, well, let's see here. Let's get to the other big foreign prospect people are talking about in the top 10. That's Mario Hezonja. And one of the things, again, that you just talked about, low free throw rate with Mudiay. Does the low free throw rate for Hezonja bother you at all?
It does. And it was incredibly low, particularly in ACB play so far this year, where he has taken 12 free throws in 555 minutes.
That's bad.
That's very bad. Somehow he actually had 24 free throws in EuroLeague play in only 354 minutes, which is a little bit better, but still not very good. I mean, the weird thing about Hezonja is the way that his skills are described is so different from how he actually plays right now, which is obviously largely a function of his role on this really deep FC Barcelona team, but it makes it a little difficult to account for statistically.
Yeah, well, so tell them, for people who aren't familiar with his game at all, what is the common perception of him versus what the reality is of what his actual production has been?
I mean, the perception is that he's an extraordinarily self-confident player, self-confident to the point of possibly destructive, and you know, really, really very athletic, which is something else that doesn't necessarily shine through in his numbers, I wouldn't say, in a big way. And you look at him and he's kind of, you know, just this spot up shooter. He's basically the European Devin Booker at this point in his career. His assist rate is pretty good. That's the one area where it's really different. But has taken more threes than twos and projects to do that in the NBA, which, you know, again, are not great signs in terms of stardom. I thought Chad Ford's comparison of him to J.R. Smith was kind of interesting, because that's someone who, you know, is the same way where this great jumper, very self-confident, but also at times, you know, in Cleveland when he was playing with their three stars, did basically just fit into that spot-up shooter role.
Yeah, and I actually, in watching him, I thought that that was a pretty decent comparison as well, because he is really athletic, as JR was in his younger days, will definitely take and make some really tough threes, and actually has a pretty decent passing vision when he decides to turn that on, as JR does. So, but not a guy who gets to the basket quite as much as his athleticism might indicate. So, yeah, I mean, Hezonja only number 22 on your board. I mean, what do you think? Is there any kind of regression the other way for the fact that his free throw rate was so low, or is that not something that you would do that for?
No, it gets regressed as well, so that helps him out a little bit. I would say that, you know, I think that Hezonja is very unlikely to fail because of the fact that he is a really good outside shooter. Like, he can just walk from the role he's playing right now into an NBA offense tomorrow, and he'll probably be fine. But that it's tough for me to see him having a great shot at being a star based on what he's doing right now.
Well, so this is actually a good time for an aside, because some of the things that have been in the news lately are that some European guards, namely Sergio Yuel, who there was a report today that he was getting a 3-year deal, potentially up to as much as $23 million. I'm not sure whether that's true or not. That was reported by some Spanish outlets. And then Sergio Rodriguez, who Blazer fans will remember, and also Marcelino Huertas, are all guys who are talking about coming to the NBA this year. How good do those guys look? They're more veterans. You've got a pretty big sample size for them. What do you think those guys would project to do in the NBA, since we're talking about European guys?
Yuel comes out as one of the best players in Europe, and that's, again, good timing, because the other thing I've got running on Tuesday, besides the Porzingis piece, is one on projecting basically every player that's has their rights held as a former draft pick.
Oh, awesome.
Yeah. So he is very near the top of that list. The $7 million a year seems like a little bit of a stretch to me. He projects is a little bit better than league average player. And, you know, he's 27 right now. He's probably not going to get a whole lot better. I do think he's a guy who can really complement James Harden well, a decent outside shooter, a guy who doesn't necessarily need the ball in his hands. He's played combo guard over the course of his career in Spain. And one of the guys he projects to, this might be damning with faint praise, but is Steve Blake, who is a guy who's kind of played a similar role to that throughout his career.
Yeah, from a scouting perspective, having seen him, I would say that he's got a little more heft to him than Blake, and someone who could potentially, you know, better defender, and even could potentially guard wing players in the NBA, assuming that they're not too big. But yeah, I mean, I think he's someone who maybe when you consider that his draft rights are still held you know, maybe that he could end up being a good value for the Rockets. But on the other hand, you know, you're saying he's kind of an average player, so maybe $7 million is too much for him. What about Rodriguez?
Rodriguez has been one of the best guys in Europe over the last few years here. So it's exciting to hear him talking about coming to the NBA again. I really enjoyed watching him play as a young player in Portland, saw him a lot in person there. And, you know, it just kind of seemed to be the situation where he couldn't find a big enough role and didn't want to stick it out, him or Rudy Fernandez, another guy who was a great deal of fun to watch. And so I have him projected as, you know, probably a fringe starting point guard in the NBA. A team that's weak at that position, I think, could potentially upgrade with him in the short term. The downside is he's going to turn 29 before the start of next season, and he's not necessarily going to be a long-term answer at this point.
Yeah, no, I mean, and so those two guys, actually, Yule and Rodriguez, are the backcourt for Real Madrid. A lot of people, some of my European friends especially, insist that that team could beat a lot of the teams in the NBA and have a better record than them over the course of the NBA season. You know, you do these European projections. Do you think that that's accurate, or are they getting a little ahead of themselves?
I do think that's accurate. I mean, they've got, you know, four or five guys that rate as average or better players, which is better than a lot of teams in the league. Their depth is kind of questionable. The end of their bench would be pretty weak. And one of the things that separates European coaches from American coaches is that they tend to play much deeper rosters as opposed to relying on their star players. But still, even with that, I have it projected that Real Madrid would be about a 37-38 win team in the league, and Barcelona would be about a 39 win team.
Oh, wow. Yeah, well, thanks for doing that. That's awesome. Well, now you're going to – my European friends are never going to shut up after hearing that now.
That's probably
But no, I mean, I happen to agree with them in large part. I mean, the only thing that I think they just don't necessarily have the athleticism, especially at the big positions, and that just not having anyone who can compete athletically with some of these guys might be an issue. But they also have a ton of experience and a ton of guys who know how to play. So how about Huertas, who plays for FC Barcelona, which you mentioned? How does he look potentially coming over?
You know, it's a couple years too late, I think, in his case. I mean, he was a guy who projected really well for a while, but now he's 32. And with that, looks like a guy who's, you know, maybe a solid backup, but not a ton more than that. Kind of similar, I think, to Pablo Prigioni when he came over.
Yeah, which is still a totally solid backup point guard, I think. Although, I don't think he has quite of Pablo's athleticism and anticipation defensively compared to Huertas, where he's, you know, I wouldn't say was ever really like that much of an athlete in any sense of the word. But yeah, I mean, certainly someone I would love to see running pick and roll with some backup units, especially a team that has a lot of guys who can, you know, catch alley-oops. I think he's pretty awesome at that. So, all right, why don't we get back to the draft? Is there anything in translating these European guys that really holds up well from Europe, or that doesn't hold up so well?
I don't know if there's anything in particular. It's a little more unpredictable, I think, than actually college to the NBA, even though it's probably closer in terms of level of competition. There are some guys that, you know, look really good and just can't adjust to the style of play. Possibly because you have guys who are, you know, like you mentioned with Huertas, point guards who have the ball in their hands all the time in Europe, and then they come to the NBA and they're not necessarily in that role. I think of Jeremy Pargo as someone like that, who was playing on maybe slightly weaker European teams and just was the man over there and then wasn't the man when he came to the NBA. But I don't know if there's one specific thing that stands out.
All right. Well, so you have Russell as number one, and from the statistics with him, what is liked about him? I mean, I actually worry that his three-point percentage may not be quite as good as it looks. Is there a regression there, or is that enough attempts that the system feels good about how he's going to shoot from three-point range?
I mean, the thing is, first off, especially with any freshman, but almost any player in general, their three-point percentage is going to get regressed pretty heavily to the mean. So he's only projected to shoot 35% next season, and yet still has the top overall long-term projection despite that. And that's because of the fact that, you know, he does a lot of other things well, I think. He doesn't the shooting sets him apart from a lot of point guards in the league, but he doesn't necessarily, it's not the only thing that sets him apart. You know, he's a good playmaker given the fact that he was sharing ball handling duties with Shannon Scott last year, a good rebounder for a guard, which is one of those factors that historically it's been surprisingly important, and then a really high usage rate for a freshman guard. So I think all of those things look good statistically.
If you had to take a stab at it, why do you think it is that rebounding rate helps when projecting a guard to the NBA? What does that show? I mean, it's not like, all right, now, you know, because you're a great rebounder, you're an awesome NBA player. It's kind of a proxy for something, isn't it?
Right. And I think there's a couple of theories on it. The one is just basically anytime you have skills that are uncommon for your position, that's generally a good thing. So big men who can pass, your Draymond Greens, that could also be a benefit. The other theory is that it's a proxy for athleticism, your ability to go up and rebound over, you know, guys that are generally much bigger than you, certainly even in college, and that's telling us something meaningful about your ability to play in traffic.
Yeah, or even just a proxy for kind of your competitiveness, that you're willing to stick your nose in there and go and get rebounds. Although, ironically, I was surprised watching on film of Russell that he actually has that high of a rebound rate, because he doesn't really compete that hard in a lot of respects, but you know, the numbers don't lie, I guess. Another guy that I think a lot of people would be really surprised to see so high is Tyus Jones. He's someone who I actually really liked a lot on film, but just, you know, is not as high in the scouting consensus because he doesn't have great size or athleticism for his position. And so why did the numbers disagree with the consensus for him?
And I think that's a fairly legitimate concern. You know, one of the guys who projected well last year, fairly similar to Jones, was Tyler Ennis from Syracuse, who then didn't play much as a rookie this year and wasn't real effective when he did get a chance to play. Jones, not one of those guys who was a big rebounder as a guard, but great assist to turnover ratio. And then the other thing is he projects as a surprisingly good shooter in the league. He shot, I think, 39% from 3-point range in college and was one of the better free throw shooters in the nation. So all of that adds up to long term, he should, I think, become a pretty good 3-point shooter in the NBA.
Yeah, I like him a lot more than Ennis because in watching Ennis, I wasn't sure what he really did well. You know, I didn't see the elite vision that I think that Jones has. And the shooting as well, I think he projects to be a much better shooter than Ennis as well. And, you know, just kind of like a smart, competitive player, something that you really like. Another guy then who scouts are a little bit lower on than the numbers is Frank Kaminsky. And I think you and I probably have our biggest disagreement on Kaminsky. So why do you think that he is going to be a real successful player? I mean, are you projecting him as like a starter level player, a star, or more of a backup? Where does your system see him landing?
I would say more of a good backup. It's weird. I think one of the questions you posed going into here was who's a guy whose numbers you don't totally believe. And actually, I might say it's Kaminsky, because I went through and did my personal draft rankings this afternoon. I wanted to have those done, and I ended up putting him 14th. So I don't know if it's how much differently you have.
Interesting. That's so what was your thinking then? Why are you having him so much lower than just on the pure numbers?
I do think that there are legitimate concerns about his defense, whether he's going to be strong enough to defend centers or quick enough to defend power forwards. And I think that probably limits him to a reserve role, at least early on in his career. So I think you're drafting him, you know, hoping for a guy who's a weapon off the bench rather than a starter or a star.
Yeah, for me, I have two problems with him, and that it's I think that he's really slow. I think that's even a bigger problem than the second one, which is I don't think he really protects the rim all that well. I think that him trying to defend NBA fours, and especially if you decided to just put a wing out there as your backup four, would be a disaster. I don't think that his whole dribble drive game thing is going to work at all in the NBA, because you can time those drives with a sundial. So that's kind of why I see him as more of a five. And then you get into, does he protect the basket well enough? Is he strong enough to defend in the post? Is he quick enough to defend in pick and roll? And that's why I think I agree with you. I think he could be a solid backup at the five, but you know, not someone who would be extended in more than about 15 minutes a game if he really has to go up against starting centers or defend the rim against starting wings and point guards.
So I think two things I will say. Number one, if you do put him at power forward, the one thing I like is he's such a good post player that you can't go small against him. He'll just destroy you in the post, and then if you double, he's got the passing ability to make plays out of that. It's a little bit of what Zach Lowe wrote about, you know, last month in terms of, you know, the revival of the post game is an antidote to teams going small against a shooter. And the fit I really like for him, even though he's not my favorite player for them, is in Utah, because you could play him with Derek Favors. That would be a great combination. And I think that Gobert may be a good enough rim protector that you could get away with playing Kaminsky in front of him.
Yeah, I still think that just playing him at the four, to me, defensively is just going to be a disaster. That's kind of how I think about it. I mean, I think he could play the four offensively just because he can shoot the ball. I am not quite as confident in his post game against guys with NBA athleticism. And, you know, I mean, in college, post defense in college is pretty bad. Like, guys just do the put my hands straight up, deactivate, and please don't call me for a foul, because they'll just call anything. but, you know, that's fine. I mean, I'm sure a lot of people would disagree with me. He was very effective in the post in college.
Yeah, and generally going against guys his own height, whereas, you know, I'm thinking about this as mostly a weapon against, you know, six foot eight guys, whereas he's a legit 7-footer.
Yeah, that's a very reasonable point, I suppose. RJ Hunter, number six for you. Not someone who's really being talked about even in the lottery, I don't think, at this point. I get the impression that he is someone that you believe in that range a little bit more than you do Kaminsky.
I do, yeah. He ended up 10th on my subjective draft board, and I could easily put him a little bit higher than that. I just, you know, he's one of those guys that the numbers pick out, and the concern for me is that I have a halo effect when I watch him play. But when I've watched him play in their tournament championships, the Sun Belt championships, and then their NCAA tournament appearance last year, I see a lot of what I saw in Klay Thompson in college. And, you know, even the negatives in some ways, the things that I that made me skeptical of Klay Thompson, I also see in RJ Hunter. So it's a little bit of maybe I'm trying overgeneralizing from that small sample size and not wanting to make the mistake again. But also, you know, he's a pure shooter with almost 6'6 size and long arms, and I think it's hard for that not to translate if he really shoots the ball as well as I think he's going to. And he's another case where, you know, his three-point percentage was not very good, particularly as a junior, but taking really tough shots, probably at times ill-advised shots, is the go-to guy in their offense, and his free throw percentage was terrific, and I think that speaks to his ability as a pure shooter.
Well, it's good to know that we get a little bit of Apple State related bias here. It wouldn't be a Pelton podcast without a little bit of something at least. But yeah, Hunter is someone I haven't had a chance to watch a ton of, but I do think that even if you're going to do the Thompson comparison, he's a little bit better handling the ball and certainly as a passer than Thompson was, and maybe even still is, at least passing the ball, although he's made some strides in those areas. All right. Well, so you mentioned then that I sent over my list of questions beforehand. Who is someone who is being talked about really highly in this draft that you are more skeptical on?
Let's see here. I would start with Devin Booker, I think. He's probably the guy who's lowest in my subjective rankings, who's going to be a lottery pick. And as I compare him to, you know, a guy like Hunter, I think that he can be as good of a shooter, but I don't see him doing almost anything else based on his college stats. His steal rate was almost impossibly bad at Kentucky, where it's, you know, like just being out there on the court accidentally, a loose ball should fall to you every now and again. And in his case, it didn't. His rebound rate is really poor. His assist rate is really poor. His block rate is really poor. And I think that there's a real chance that, you know, he ends up more of an Anthony Morrow type or a Wayne Ellington type in the NBA than, you know, the kind of guys that he's being compared to is a lottery pick.
Yeah, I have him as number 32 on your board. I'm adjusting to that because you had Mark Garcia pretty high, but he's not in the draft now, so I think I moved everyone up one. And another guy who's really low for you, at least in the warp rankings, I'm guessing higher from a subjective standpoint, is Justice Winslow.
Yeah, I've come around on Justice Winslow a little bit. I was skeptical, but you know, he had some very different seasons. If you look at his numbers, he had, you know, the non-conference play, he was okay. And then he had a couple weeks stretch in the ACC, early in ACC play, where he was dealing with some injuries, and he was horrendous. And then the second half of the season, he played like a, you know, a borderline top five pick, like the kind of guy he's being projected as. People got too crazy on him during the NCAA tournament. This whole tell me why Justice Winslow isn't the number one pick. Like, slow down. Let's all remain calm. The whole season counts, not just the NCAA tournament. But I mean, I love watching him play. I love the kind of player that he is, much as everyone else does. I love all the intangibles. I'm a little less sold that he's going to be a valuable offensive player than everyone else, but it's hard to see him failing because he's so good at defense.
Yeah, I agree with that. Why do you think that – what is it that other people are seeing in his offense that – you/the numbers don't see as much?
I mean, the one thing maybe the 40% three-point shooting, the 40% plus three-point shooting, which again gets regressed heavily to the mean. And then he wasn't a real high percentage finisher as a two-point shooter, partially because, as you've mentioned in past podcasts, he was such a poor shooter on long twos when he was pulling up off the dribble.
Yeah, and his free throw shooting, 64%, not amazing either. So that's got to be a concern as well, and I'm guessing part of why that three-point percentage, that over 40% gets regressed.
Right. It's not explicitly part of the formula, but subjectively definitely factors in. And then, you know, he was only an average rebounder for a small forward, which I think people think of him as a better rebounder. That and his steal and block, his block rate was pretty good. His steal rate, you know, was above average, but not outstanding.
Yeah, I'd love to know how Duke won the national championship when Okafor, Winslow, and Tyus Jones, both apparently, all three of them apparently can't get any rebounds.
All the other Plumlee brother.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, in his like 10 minutes a game or whatever it was. Cameron Payne is another guy that I've been really interested in. Watched a fair amount of him. Really, really enjoy his game. Just knows how to play. He's a baller. You know, that's how Mike Schmitz described him. You know, great hesitations, shoots the ball pretty well, but also, and you know, good pick and roll operator, has a fantastic floater game, maybe the best of any prospect in this draft. And how does your system then adjust for the fact that he played in the Ohio Valley Conference, really only played one good team that you'd think of as a real good team all year in Xavier?
Yeah, that's one of the bigger challenges, I think, for a statistical projection system, and one of the places where you can see the most variation, I guess I would say, between them. And so when I did these projections a few years ago, when they were public at Basketball Prospectus, there was a really high strength of schedule adjustment. And what I found out then, looking back and kind of recalibrating things, is that I had underrated guys like Steph Curry and Damian Lillard, who came into the league and were really effective despite coming out of these conferences where they didn't face particularly strong competition. So I turned it down because of that. And now Payne is a guy that still comes out as a pretty good prospect. He's one of those, had this interesting situation where I think, you know, during the college season, I had him rated higher than almost anyone else. He ends up 11th in the warp projections. And then all of a sudden, like, he's working out for the Sacramento Kings and the New York Knicks. And it's like, wait, now am I lower on Cameron Payne than everyone else? So that's a weird one.
Yeah, it is. So why do you think it is then that the level of competition doesn't seem to matter that much, at least in your projections with some of these guys?
And it still does matter, you know. It's just not as strong as it was before. I mean, I don't know if I have a good explanation for it besides observing it. It's just that, you know, I guess some of these skills, especially these guards, demonstrate at the lower levels, you know, they carry over more easily. Your ability to make an open shot or run the pick and roll is different, I guess. Depending on the strength of schedule, strength of opposition, is, you know, like something like rebounding, where there's only one rebound that everyone can get.
Yeah, and I guess also offensively, if you're so much better than all the rest of these guys on both your own team and the other team, they're going to now, much like you were talking about with RJ Hunter, really, really adjust to you and try and put all their defense towards stopping you. So maybe those factors kind of balance out versus, you know, if you have someone like Carl Towns, for example, not that I don't think he's going to be awesome, but there's four other McDonald's All-Americans you have to worry about in Kentucky, whereas Campaign, he's the guy who has the ball in his hand every time, and the defense is geared towards stopping him all the time.
Yeah, it's a very different context from oftentimes what you're going to be doing in the NBA. But like I said, that's one of the biggest distinctions I think people have seen the statistical plus-minus-based system that ESPN Stats and Info put together and rolled out on 538 last week. And one of the factors that they include in there is a team offensive and defensive component, and therefore all the Kentucky guys end up rating really well, and some of the mid-major players don't rate as well in their projections.
Yeah, I haven't had a chance to read about that. Can you explain to the listeners, and to me, this will be my first time hearing about it, how that system works? This is based on then the plus minus of their college teams when they were on the floor or off the floor, basically?
No, I think it's overall offensive and defensive efficiency. I don't think that if we have access to the Encore, I am not aware of that, at least.
Okay.
Yeah.
So it basically then says, all right, Kentucky was one of the best defensive teams we've seen. Carl Towns, maybe you didn't have a ridiculously high block rate, but we're going to give you credit for the fact that you are a big component of Kentucky just stopping people. Is that kind of how it works?
Yeah, and I think one of the other effects it's picking up, Lane Vacheron's projections have a specific interaction effect of, like rebounding is diminished by, if you're Cauley Stein playing next to Towns, there's not as many rebounds to go around. And if you're Lyles playing next to both of them on the perimeter, there's really not as many rebounds to go around. So I think it is capturing some of that effect, which I do not account for in my projections.
Yeah, no, I mean, and it's definitely hard to account for all that, and there's just so many variables in this, and that's what makes the draft so fun, is that everyone can have their own opinion, and you can come up with a justification for it, and then everyone forgets what you said. Just kidding on that last part, everyone. I'm quite sure my podcast listeners will remember what I said if I get something wrong. All right, so someone who now is projected a little bit lower, but is someone that you think could be a potential steal later on in the draft?
I would say late in the first round, DeLon Wright, besides the guys that we've already talked about. And, as you mentioned, there's a lot of diversity among the statistical projections. This year, I think more so than in years past. I actually looked at that with the 538 ESPN Stats and Info. There was a stronger correlation in past years between my projections and theirs than there was this year. Which I don't really have a good answer for why that would be, but it is the case. But almost all the projections seem to agree that DeLon Wright is undervalued late in the first round because he's a guy who absolutely stuffs the box score. A good passer, a true point guard at 6'5.5", great steal rate, great rebound rate, block shots, does everything well except shoot, basically.
Yeah, so, misses from three-point range are part of the box score as well.
That is true. Crooked numbers.
I watched a little film of him, not a ton, because it's tough to find time to watch all these guys, but I was very impressed with his defense as well. I do think he's someone who I have difficulty seeing him failing completely. I think at the very least he could be a good defensive backup point guard, someone who can then guard the two as well against backups, playmake on the backside, even if he's not the main guy running a pick and roll. But he's also 23, and usually that is a big red flag for some of these guys in the past. Is it just that his production is so good that that doesn't matter?
Yeah, I mean, the 23-year-olds have not been great as a group. I think also partially most of the guys that have been that kind of player have not been as athletic or as talented as DeLon Wright. He spent 2 years at junior college because he didn't qualify academically, and then only had the 1 year at Utah, and scouts weren't really convinced, so he stuck around for his fourth year and came back, even though I think he probably was draftable. If I had been running a team, I would have desperately wanted him to come out last year so I could grab him in the second round. The big thing with Wright to me is it's all about his fit. The scenario I can see for him where he's not as valuable is he ends up kind of like Evan Turner with defense, where he's a guy who needs the ball in his hands to be effective, but he's not quite good enough with the ball in his hands that you really want him doing that on a good team. So I can see that problem for him on offense. But if he goes to a team where he gets to run a bunch of pick and rolls, like Dallas is what I am really hoping for in the draft. If they could turn him loose as the starting point guard next year with Dirk Nowitzki, it would be amazing.
Yeah, that would be pretty remarkable if you were to go to Dallas and actually start as the guy drafted that late. What was I going to say here?
He has the best, though, rookie projection on a per-minute basis of anybody in my projections.
Wow, that's remarkable. I mean, granted, you would expect that since he's 3 years older than a lot of these guys. Can you remember anyone else who came out at 23 or older who succeeded? The only one I can remember off the top of my head is Taj Gibson, who I think was actually 24 when he was drafted.
Yeah, Gibson makes sense. I mean, it depends. You want to count Miles Plumlee? I think he was also that old.
Oh, Miles Plumlee. Yeah, he was 24. And even Mason Plumlee, I think, was 23 when he came out. You can count those guys probably all have exceeded where they were drafted in terms of their production, although Miles couldn't get off the bench for the Bucks in the playoffs, but
wait, here's one that actually is kind of somewhat similar to him. Josh Howard was 23 even.
Oh, that's a good one. Yeah, Josh Howard was a great player for a while. I mean, it is kind of funny to think about it though. Like, it's a great advertisement for why you need to come out of school earlier if you ever possibly can. It doesn't seem like Wright really had that option, but okay, he gets drafted in the first round. 4 years, and then he's getting his second contract when he's 27, and then, you know, he's basically one more contract, and he's out of the league. You really only have one chance to get a non-rookie scale deal that way, whereas you can get two. It's really just such a big difference in the amount you can make if you come out earlier. And then also there's your research that has shown that guys develop better in the NBA than in college as well. So it's really kind of a no-brainer to come out earlier, I guess, if you can.
Don't stay in school, kids.
Yeah, I mean, I guess we can discuss the college basketball industrial complex some other time. another guy that I looked at today because you had ranked him at number 19 in your WAR projection was Cedi Osman. I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly. Cedi Osman, Turkish player. He reminded me a lot on film of Corey Brewer, and he's someone that you like a little bit as well. Tell me about what the system thinks that he is going to be able to do if he gets drafted.
Yeah, I think he benefits a little bit, probably more than he should, from the regression to the mean on his three-point shooting, which is probably his biggest weakness. And it kind of works to the benefit of some of the young European guys because the system says, well, they probably can't be this bad at three-point shooting. But the scouting report says, yeah, they actually probably are this bad. But he also does a lot of other things well. You know, he's versatile enough, I think, you know, rebounds well enough to play small forward, handles the ball well enough to maybe even play a little bit of point guard, probably more realistically shooting guard, good size for all of those spots. And, I think an interesting draft and stash prospect.
Yeah, I agree with you. And, I mean, let's keep in mind, too, on his three-point shooting, granted, his free throw percentage isn't great. It's in the high 60s. But we're kind of tougher on some of these European guys with shooting than we might be if they're in college because they're playing with a 22-foot line.
Right.
He just turned 20. I mean, if he's a sophomore in college and, you know, he's shooting at a line that's a foot and a half shorter, we probably wouldn't be freaking out about this. But, you know, when you see him playing on a professional team, it stands out a little bit more among all these guys who can shoot. So, but I really like him a lot. He reminds me of Corey Brewer. He'll get out and transition. Not quite the dunker that Corey Brewer is, but probably a better penetrator, I would say. He has a really good understanding of angles. He's got some good moves off the dribble as well, some nice hesitations and spin moves. So someone who is just, you know, I didn't watch enough of him to really come to a great opinion. It was really only about 45 minutes. But someone who just kind of popped off the screen as a guy who does things a little bit differently and takes some interesting angles in attacking the basket and also plays extremely hard. So someone I think we should watch.
Yeah, Frank Fraschilla seems fairly high on him. So I'd say he's my number two draft and stash guy. The guy I like the most is Guillermo Vili Hernan Gomez, who is playing with Kristaps Porzingis in Spain.
Yeah, so what do you like about him? I saw him at the Eurocamp a couple of years ago. Also have seen a reasonable amount of him on film in the course of watching Porzingis. But yeah, what's the appeal there?
Below the rim big man, but another guy who, like Porzingis, used a pretty high percentage of his team's plays in ACB play. Really terrific offensive rebounder. I think him and Dakari Johnson from Kentucky are probably the two best offensive rebounders in the draft. And then a good steal rate, even though he doesn't have a good block rate. So, could be more of like a Nene type defender, I think, potentially.
Interesting. Yeah, I don't quite see him that way. I mean, Nene had some really long arms, and I think is a lot more athletic than Willie. I mean, he's definitely a great, great kid. I think like he was the guy at the Eurocamp that the coaches always asked to demonstrate all the drills because they knew that he would do it right, and you could tell just the way they talked to him and then just like kind of convincing with him afterwards that his basketball intelligence was something that they really liked. Certainly, when you see the numbers that he's been able to put up, you know, not someone who's going to dunk on you. Do you see him as more of a center or a power forward?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I haven't watched enough of him to know defensively whether he can defend on the perimeter at all. That's probably going to be a challenge for him, but not a good block rate. So he won't be a terrific rim protector. The other guy that I kind of think of statistically with him is Pekovic. Not his high percentage of finisher, but in that kind of mold.
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, seeing him in person, and this was 2 years ago, so maybe he's put on some more weight or even grown a little bit. I did think of him as more kind of a power forward size with a center's game, and that would be my reservation about him. But yeah, I mean, as a draft and stash guy that the statistics already like and putting up good numbers at a young age in a great league, you know, why not? I mean, I think he's got a better chance of hitting. I mean, at least with a lot of these guys, you know, in the 25 to 40 range, you don't really have much reason to believe that they're going to hit. And so I think that's where, you know, we talked to one of the guys we disagreed on last year was Capella. It's looking like you're more right about him. But I thought those started to be a good pick around 25 because at least now you have some reason, his great statistical translations, to believe that he's going to really work out, whereas, you know, some of these other guys are kind of middling in pretty much all respects.
Right, they're probably at best going to be role players, but I already took my Capella victory lap during the playoffs, so I don't need to do that again.
Yeah, we'll see how he does in longer minutes. But yeah, he was someone who was in like your top five last year, wasn't he?
I believe he was number two overall. He's one of the handful of European prospects, him and Yusuf Nurkic, who was also in last year's draft. Them and Ruby are, I believe, the three guys who project better than Porzingis, or have projected.
Yeah, and Nurkic was someone I got turned on to, I think, initially because of your stats. Then I really liked what I saw of him on film. I think he looks like he's going to be a pretty good prospect, especially considering where he was drafted also. So I guess you can chalk those two up as wins for your projection system. All right, let's see here. Who else did I want to ask you about? There's a couple other guys. Christian Wood. Have you seen much of him? And I think you've got him at 21. He's a guy who I watched some of again today as well. Really popped out to me on film as having long arms, nice bounce, excellent shot blocker, basically the age of the same guy as Towns, or the same age as Towns, even though he's a sophomore, can shoot the ball. A little bit kind of at wax and waning effort guy, but what kind of statistical thoughts are there on him?
Yeah, I mean, I think you made a good point that you kind of think of him as like a one-and-done prospect, and in that context, then his stats look really pretty impressive. So, yeah, good block rate, as you mentioned, decent, not great rebounder. Hasn't been a good percentage three-point shooter yet, but I think has the chance to possibly do that. I see him and Kevon Looney as being pretty similar prospects. Looney was a guy who was talked about as a lottery pick entering the season, and then has slipped pretty dramatically into, you know, around the 20 range now, which is probably about where I had him all along statistically. Wood, it seems like the big concern with him is off the court. His interviews have not apparently gone well.
Yeah, that's a shame. I mean, but he's definitely, you know, again, another guy who, when you're getting into that 20 to 30, 35 range, you want to find something about them that says, okay, this could be special. I mean, it gives you some reason to think that this could work out, whether it's, you know, his amazing athleticism and physical tools, you know, even though he has these flaws that you talked about, whether it's Hernan Gomez translating pretty well. All of those are reasons why you might like decide to go for someone there and at least can talk yourself into him. Yeah, I guess this will probably be the last one here. Willie Cauley-Stein, number 35 on your list.
Yeah, he is definitely probably the biggest outlier, I would say. And this is a case where I am not really trusting the stats because, you know, first off, there's the effect we mentioned where he's playing at Kentucky and playing alongside all these other guys. That's probably one factor in why he's not been a better rebounder. I don't think he's going to be a good rebounder in the NBA, and that's why I think the comparisons to, you know, Tyson Chandler and DeAndre Jordan, guys who single-handedly dominated the defensive glass in their prime, are a bit of a stretch in my opinion. But he's probably going to be better than we saw. He had an amazing block rate the 1 year he actually played center when he wasn't playing alongside either Noel or Karl Anthony Towns, the two other, you know, lottery picks who have been at Kentucky. And then just his individual defensive versatility, I think, is something that probably is not getting picked up in the numbers. So, you know, I think fans are getting a little too excited about him because it's easy with defensive guys. You say, oh, well, his floor is going to be guy who's one of the best defenders in the league. This happened with, you know, Victor Oladipo and Tony Allen a couple of years ago. Like, oh, worst case scenario is Tony Allen. Like, no, worst case scenario, he's not the best perimeter defender of his generation because there's way more uncertainty about how defense translates from college basketball to the NBA than you're giving credence there. But he does have the chance to be a really, really good defender, and I don't think he's going to hurt you too terribly on the offensive end, even though he's got a really low usage rate, high turnover rate. He's probably not going to be involved very much. He'll be like kind of a silent drain on the offense.
Yeah, I mean, I think he has to be a center. I mean, he can hold up at power forward defensively, I think, and might even be pretty good there. And getting that shot blocking at the power forward position would be nice. But, yeah, I mean, he's one of these guys who, like, you know, he can be smooth at times. Like, he'll catch the ball at the free throw line, make, like, a nice move, take one dribble to the basket, and then just, like, throw the ball off the backboard. It's like it's pretty. I mean, he just doesn't really seem to have much offensive feel. The way he moves kind of reminds me a little bit of Kenyon Martin. That's kind of like a big guy who could, you know, even was asked to defend Kobe Bryant at times by George Karl in Denver. Probably not the offensive game that Martin had when he was younger, but that's who he reminds me of from a defensive standpoint.
I can see that in terms of the way he moves. Yeah, I know there's some people that are, getting excited about, oh, he's making jumpers and workouts, but he's a 50% free throw shooter, so I'm not too confident that he's eventually going to emerge as a floor stretcher. So that raises some questions if you're pairing him with a guy like DeMarcus Cousins to me.
Yeah, I never saw him fitting at all in Sacramento unless they just, you know, trade down and want to get a backup center, which they do need. And he could be pretty good defensively, but yeah, unless they basically would never score with him and Cousins and no one who can make a shot really on the perimeter either. Oh yeah, this is the real, real last thing now. Dario Saric, how did he do last year? There's some talk he might come over this year. It looks like that's not going to happen now, but is he kind of on track to where we thought he would be after when he was drafted? Is he better, worse? How's he looking?
I would say slightly better. So, you know, I only have EuroLeague translations for him last year because he played in the Greek League, which is probably the biggest league for which I do not have translations at this point. But last year was an interesting effect where he didn't play very well in EuroCup, but was really good in the Adriatic League, which was where he was playing his club basketball before primarily. And, you know, this year he was much stronger in the European competitions. That improves his projection overall. He still doesn't rate well statistically. Part of the reason is he gets hurt by the regression factor. He's such a versatile player that there's no one position that, you know, regressing him to the positional averages ends up working out for him, if that makes sense. This kind of hurt Kyle Anderson from UCLA in last year's draft. I think he's going to – I'm not convinced he's a starter yet, a good starter yet. I think, you know, there's a chance that he may be more of a super six man, kind of like a Tony Kukoc mold.
Yeah, and although I think what separates him from Kukoc is, you know, he's only really not a good shooter from what I've seen. I think he shot 30% this year in the EuroLeague, so from three. And that to me is sort of the thing. You talked about guys coming over from Europe who need to have the ball in their hands. That's really what makes him a special player, is what he can do with the ball in his hands at his size. But is he actually going to be good enough at that to be one of the primary guys handling the ball in the NBA? Are you going to get enough shooting around him? And then also what position he defends as well, whether he's, you know, he's 6'10", but short arms. I mean, I thought he was a good pick at 12 because he does have those special skills like you talked about, but, you know, I'm not quite ready to anoint him as really like a high level starter, as you said.
Yeah, and I think Philly is one of the few teams. He's more valuable to Philly than almost anyone else because it's not a big deal for them to wait. But if he does miss the third year to try to wait until he can get off his rookie contract, that hurts them both in terms of the patience of him missing another year, and then also because a lot of the reason you draft a guy 12th is to get the value of that rookie contract. And so, you know, you can still get a good value. I think Nikola Mirotic is going to be a really good value for Chicago on his non-rookie deal that he signed with exclusive rights, but not as valuable.
Yeah, and it's funny because I think actually if they wait until next year and they get him on the rookie scale deal next year, that's actually a coup for them because, I mean, having his production these last 2 years and starting the clock on his rookie extension, that doesn't do you any good. You're not good. This isn't a team that's going anywhere anyway. So you might as well then lock him up from, you know, ages 22 to 26 instead of 20 to 24 on that rookie deal. But then, of course, if he waits another year and then he's not subject to the rookie scale anymore, now you're paying him more. You probably get him only for a three-year deal instead of four. And then, you know, it ends up kind of backfiring. So it'll be very interesting to see what ends up happening there, whether he decides to come over a year later or not.
Yeah, a lot of incentive for him to wait a year, certainly, but we've seen it play out the other way. Ricky Rubio came after 2 years and did play out his rookie deal before eventually signing that big extension with Minnesota.
Yeah, that's true, too. I mean, it was 2 years. I think that a big part of that, too, is just that the economy in Europe wasn't as good as when he was drafted, at least the basketball economy. So that was a big part of that. All right, well, so should I put you on the spot here? You got another recommendation, or should we save that for next time?
No, I actually do have another recommendation.
Right. Well, good, because I am quite sure that every single one of our listeners has already finished the book that you recommended, except for, and they are going to need another recommendation. I, unfortunately, have not yet started it. That's probably going to be for after free agency. I hope that my podcast listeners and you will forgive me for recording this podcast every night instead of reading for an hour, but hopefully we're all better off for that. So what's your recommendation this time?
Well, first off, I want to note, so the book I recommended last time was The Boys in the Boat, about the UW 1936 Olympic crew team that won the gold medal. And who was spotted, pictured on the flight home from Cleveland from winning the championship while reading that book, but Steve Kerr? So we can only assume that you heard about it here.
I would have guessed Maurice Spates, but Steve Kerr was my second choice there. Yeah, no, that's true. There was that he's like reading the book on the plane while holding the Larry O'Brien trophy in his other hand. It was fantastic.
And wearing his Seahawks t-shirt. It was my single favorite photo ever.
Yeah, well, you should definitely tweet KP at K Pelton if you read that book, and I'm sure he would appreciate knowing your recommendations. I mean, I'm sure, and you know, I guess you're a little intimidated that you might be deluged by all 200 listeners of mine tweeting you how they read the book. But, you know, I think it's fine. We can waste his time like that. It's okay.
That many of right David now. Locke's listeners already tweet me to thank me for appearing on his podcast. So, used to it. All right, anyway, to actually get to my recommendation.
Yes, yes.
Another book, The Drunkard's Walk, How Randomness Rules Our Lives. I don't know, some of your listeners may be familiar with Thinking Fast or Slow, which was probably, to me, the most important book written in the last 10 years about, you know, how our minds work and kind of trick ourselves into believing things that aren't true, which is really interesting in the context of basketball. When it first came out, I wrote a piece for Basketball Prospectus about the implications in the NBA and then for all of our lives. And this is a book very much in a similar spirit, more specifically statistically driven, but cites thinking fast or slow quite a bit. But a very readable book that kind of explains how random chance, how it don't seem random even when they are, and how this can trick us, and how you can sort of think about this in a better way.
Yeah, that's actually, I may read that one before The Boys in the Boat, actually, because that's something that especially when you're just watching players play, whether it's, you know, in an NBA game, whether it's prospects, that's something to always remember, is almost like your default explanation for something happening should be, well, this is random chance,
yeah,
you know, and now prove to me that it isn't, as opposed to, all right, well, this guy missed a free throw, he's not clutch now, you know, where it's like that sort of thing, because you missed one free throw, when in reality, it's probably just random that happened. And I think that's something very important to remember, is that a lot of times it's just random. And we as humans have this idea that, you know, the way we survive is by trying to process information and find patterns and form a plan of action. But, you know, especially when you're dealing with something like this, where, you know, the forces at bay, we don't even necessarily understand all of them, you know, what makes a guy miss a shot or something like that, that it really can just be randomness, as unsatisfying as that explanation really is.
Yeah, it's boring sometimes to just say, oh, that's random. But
good thing we just talked about that for like a good 5 minutes.
But it's the upside is that when you find something that isn't random, it becomes more powerful when you say that, if it's in the context of knowing that most things are random.
All right. Well, I'll tell you what is not random is you coming on and doing an awesome podcast. Definitely give Kevin a follow on Twitter at @KPelton. If you use like an RSS feed or something for articles, go into the search for Kevin Pelton on ESPN. And if you follow that RSS feed, anytime he does a new article, it'll show up. I have subscribed to that since before we even knew each other. So I would get a notification whenever he came out with a new article. His draft stuff is amazing. Thanks so much for coming on, KP.
Always a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
All right. Danny and I will be on with some more off-season stuff tomorrow night. Obviously, the draft is coming up on Thursday. We will be wrapping all that up as well. May have one more draft podcast, or it'll just be more off-season previews and cap stuff. And we will talk to you all tomorrow night. Thanks for listening.